Thank you for listening to the serialized podcast version of The Mark of a Druid, a fiction fantasy novel written and read by Rhonda R. Carpenter. I suggest that you start the story at the beginning, and to be sure that you get all of the episodes, go to themarkofadruid.com or rhondacarpenter.com. Episode 7. Chapter 10. Everything Changes. Cosmo stalked down the stairs to the living room. Had he been human, the staircase itself would have vibrated. Kaz pawed at the stereo cabinet. He tried to squeeze himself alongside the wall, but couldn't force his way between it and the massive piece of furniture. The cat yowled and rubbed against the cabinet door. Thin orange fur floated into the air above him. His hackles stood at attention. His tail puffed up to twice its normal size. He emitted a low growl from deep in his chest. He sat, tilting his head from side to side, never removing his glare from the cabinet door. A moan came from upstairs, and at once he was up the steps and at Eve's side. The wind whipped through Alion's hair. Athene clung so tightly to her sister's hand that Alion could no longer feel her fingers. All will be well, little bird. Where do we go, Alion? Father said to a new home, where we will be safe. I know no more than you, little bird. Athene released her death grip on Alion's hand, and she stretched numb fingers to bring the blood flow back again. Alion knew only that everything was changing. The bow of Knut's ship cut through the river's water. The fleet of 10 ships moved steadily toward the open sea. It had been a week of furious preparation to make the whole of the small village ready for this move. The ships had come to take the clan to a new land. "War and turbulence will come. Battle will tear us asunder," her father had said. "A new king has come to the throne of England." Alion's father, Knut, had always been a powerful force in her world. While making ready for this move, Alion had learned just how powerful a force he was in the world of her people. He'd spent little time with the girls since the death of Aroque. He had come and gone as he had seen fit, and that was only right. Never spending the long winters with the girls, he would appear in spring, if he came at all. Alion had thought nothing of this until a few days ago. He had appeared on a foggy night. Since his arrival, everyone in the village had bustled from place to place, packing what could be carried and not much more. They had stocked food supplies, healing herbs, and gathered the animals for the move. Returning to the village after collecting the plants and barks Dubjila had sent Alion to retrieve, she stopped at the central longhouse, hoping to steal a minute of her father's time. It had been more than a full year since she saw him last, and having him so close was a stronger pull on her heart than she would admit to anyone. She poked her head around the corner of the doorway. The loud voice of Min inside startled her, causing her to almost run away. The booming voice of Knut and the slam of a fist on the table was clear even to her, though she had no real view of the great hall. "You will do as you are told and gather your belongings, or you will die at the hands of Forkbeard's enemies. The choice is yours, Orm, but I tell you, Allthred's men will come, and I have need of your sword at my side. If my father is to remain king, we must gather forces now." The groan from the other side of the table must have been Orm, but Alion could not be sure. Before she could move closer, someone else spoke. His voice she did not recognize. "Once we reach Wales, will you be returning to Northumbria, or will we be staging the attacks from the new site in Wales? Once the village is settled in the new location, away from attack, we will move on to Northumbria. From there, we will invade. There, we can gather ships and men." The girls, what of them? She did not recognize that voice either. "I've no time to waste on children. They'll be safe enough in Wales. Forkbeard was stranded there after a great storm. He forged an alliance with Edwin, who is now a king in his own right. Edwin has agreed to provide sanctuary for our people, at a price. I have promised Athene to his youngest son. Enough of this!" Canute's words rang in Alion's ears. Questions spun in her mind. Why Northumbria? Why is he not taking us with him? Her heart sank. Athene promised to a Welshman? Father is not going to stay with us. Alion had known that already in some deep recess of her mind. But hearing the words devastated her. Canute had lost a part of himself when Aroque died, and the girls only reminded him of that loss. They had been replaced, Athene and Alion, by the need to fight for a kingship he had shown no interest in holding before now. "'Tis too much," Alion said, as she placed the questions in the back of her mind. She rushed off to deliver the basket to Dabjila. When she reached the lodge, Athene was waiting for her. Alion had pulled the little girl into her arms and hugged her tightly. She wiggled out of Alion's arms with a harumph and stood with her hands on her hips. At the age of 7 winters, Athene would not allow long embraces, as she had when she was a babe. Dabjila stared down at Alion with questioning eyes. However, the healer did not ask what was on her mind. There was too much to do and little time to waste. That night, Alion stretched out on her bed with her arms folded over her chest. Hot tears rolled down her face. Crying was a luxury she would never allow herself in front of others. Not even her sister had seen her cry in at least the past 3 seasons. Wishing that her mother were still alive, Alion finally went to sleep. She dreamt of Aroque that night. Alion stood at a circle of stones that she had never seen before. Aroque waved the child forward. Beside Aroque was the same red-haired woman who had held Alion in her arms when Athene had been sick some 3 years before. They both called Alion forward. As she stepped into the stone circle, the wind howled, and a dark cloud covered the bright full moon. As she came nearer to Aroque, Alion could see that her mother smiled while she spoke. "Alion of the red hair, England splits apart, and it will not be long before destiny calls you. When it does, you must not look back. All that was done with what we thought best at the time, and is now long over. Look to the lion for the truth of your birthright. It looms on the horizon." The red-haired woman reached out and held Alion in her arms. She had the look of Aroque, in her strong jaw and high cheekbones. When their eyes met, a look of unspoken love was communicated one to the other. Alion recognized this look as one she often shared with Athene. As the red-haired woman released Alion, she asked, "Who are you?" But the wind whipped through the stones, whistling its lonely tune, and the women were gone, just like vapors of fog vanishing in the early morning sun. Left alone within the standing stones, Alion called to her mother, but there was no response. Then, from the corner of her eye, she caught movement just outside the stones. Alion held her breath suddenly when she saw what the movement was. A solidly built black wolf lurked there at the edge of the circle. Her heart raced, her pulse pounded in her ears. She began to run. The wolf did not attack. It simply followed her at a slow trot, watching with its golden eyes as if it were protecting her. From what she knew of wolves, he was more likely playing with his prey. Alion awoke, winded and trembling. She sat up and looked around the lodge. The fire was low. She rose to bank it. Soaked with sweat, her hands shook, and her breathing came in short, shallow gasps. Orion's shriek brought Alion back from her thoughts. To the deck of the ship, Athene held onto her skirt as the ship lurched in the water. The girls settled into the voyage. Alion made a pallet of furs for her sister to sit on and told the child to be still. Dabjila and Canute were speaking. Both their faces were red, and the veins of her father's neck stood out as he flailed his arms in dramatic fashion, showing his displeasure. Alion could not hear, for the wind had whisked their voices off into the air. As she moved closer, the conversation stopped suddenly. In a shy voice, Alion asked, "Father, may I help?" The crease between his eyes told her the answer without the need for words. Dabjila grabbed Alion's hand, swung her around, and practically dragged her back to Athene, who asked with wide eyes, "What's wrong with Dabjila?"
"I don't know."
"Shh," she She looked at Dubjila. "Were you having a row with father?" Alian asked. Dubjila's eyes turned to the river. The old healer took several long breaths and still did not answer for quite some time. Alian cupped Athene's hand and patiently waited. "Alian, many things are changing, and it seems your father with them. He'll not be returning after we've settled." She was shocked. Her mouth opened. All she could manage was a stuttered, "Why?" "Alian, it is the cross." She looked at Dubjila with some disbelief. "What do you mean, the cross?" "He was baptized in the Christian faith at the urging of his father, Forkbeard. He has forsaken the gods of your mother's people and has sworn faith to the Christian god." "How can this be?" Alian was shocked. "Why would he do this? Is it so easy to change gods? What does this mean for Athene? Will we never see him again?" Alian had little knowledge of the Christian faith or what it was about, except that the Christians had only one god. That was just a foolish notion, being druid. It seemed impudent to her that there was only one god. The unending stream of questions sprang from her lips, receiving no answer from Dubjila. She looked down, moved to her knees, and spoke in a low voice so others could not hear. "I do not know his reasons. I know I do not believe that faith is easily or without long thought changed. What this means to you? Only time will tell. Both you and Athene will stay with me as Arok wished it." She placed her index finger under Athene's chin, tilting her head up so that the little girl was looking at Dubjila's smiling face. Then, with her thumb, she caressed the point of Athene's chin as she finished speaking. "You will be fostered in the beliefs of your mother's people. Alian, you are a spirit walker and your sister a truth-sayer. Never forget that he treated Arok well and with a truly gentle love. You are both part of her family. That will never change, not to mention the mark." Her voice trailed off. She stood and moved to the side of the ship. She looked out to the water as it silently continued its pace with the rising tide. Chapter 11. Wildcat. David Landrum held the microphone in his right hand, while his left hand moved over the mixing dials of his recording equipment. The corner of his mouth turned up when he achieved the right level for the music. His soft whisper was no longer audible to the naked ear. "Remember, remember," came his words, deeper and deeper into the past, to a time before you were you, to a time before you were born, a time before you were James Forrest. He allowed the music to play for just a moment, and then he continued, "We have lived as friends for many lifetimes. Remember now." His voice cracked from the hours of long use, then rose with emphasis. "You will come to me if ever there is a need to share your knowledge. You will call me your friend." His fingers moved by feel over the controls, turning up the echo as he said the next words. "You will do as you are told. Remember, Nosta, my friend. Nosta." He fell silent, allowing the music alone to fill the remaining few minutes of tape. He yawned. "Another all-nighter." David stretched, then reached for the phone, clearing his throat while he dialed Eve's number. After the third ring, the answering machine engaged. "Hey, Eve, can I take you to dinner? Do you have time this week? I'd like to talk to you before the staff meeting." "Well, call me back soon." And in Welsh, he asked, "What is your name?" He set the phone in the cradle. A devious smirk lingered on thin lips. David knew she would say yes. She didn't have a choice. He'd made sure of that. He slipped each unlabeled recording into its case and wrote on a yellow sticky note in bold print, "Check out the new music. Instrumental." He attached the same note to all three tapes. Those would be handled tonight. One was for Andrea McMurray. It was time she was dealt with as well, he thought. He slipped her tape into his right jacket pocket, then placed the other two into his left pocket with a pat. "These are for Eve." The remaining tapes, now marked with James, Lori, and Lisa's names, he put into his briefcase for Monday. He pulled the month-at-a-glance calendar in front of him. David marked off yesterday's square with a red marker. Yet another day closer, my love, he whispered. He drew a capital letter A in the next block and circled the day and date. Sunday, February 25th. He hung the calendar onto the nail in the wall and picked up his keys. The automated lights in the room shut off with a snap of his fingers. He walked out of the studio. He closed the door as he left his two-bedroom apartment and took the elevator down to the first-floor parking garage. The complex was huge, but he had lucked into a front-row parking spot the night before. He slipped behind the wheel of his pale-blue sports car and left the parking lot with tires squealing against shiny pavement. David adjusted the rearview mirror, slicked his bone-straight dishwater blonde hair, and tucked it neatly behind his ear, his pale brown eyes locked onto the road. He'd called Andrea a few days before, hoping she would agree to listen to the first recording. Once that was accomplished, he would never need to ask again. Just like the others, he thought. The post-hypnotic suggestion would take care of that for him. David's attention was consumed with the conversation that played out in his mind. Andrea, this is David Landrum.
Hello, David. I haven't spoken to you in quite some time. How is everything?
Well, the project is going very well, but that's not why I'm calling.
Is there something I can help you with?
Actually, there is. I've been playing around with some background music for hypnosis. The music itself produces an alpha state. I was wondering if you would have a listen and give me your opinion before I take this to the next step.
Well, I don't see why not. I'm always interested in improving the depth of a client's trance.
Great. Will you be around this weekend? I can drop it off, David asked.
I will. Shall we say Sunday, late afternoon?
That's fine. Do you want me to call first?
No, I'll be at the house. Do you remember how to get here?
Yes. Good then, I'll see you on Sunday afternoon. Thanks again.
He almost laughed.
She wanted to give him directions. Of course he remembered how to get there. He'd actually spent a great deal of time and effort to be sure he knew where Andrea McMurray lived and how to get there from several different locations. He'd even driven her subdivision a dozen times in the last month alone. He pulled onto Andrea's street and was surprised her new car wasn't in the driveway. The lights were on in the kitchen, but no one answered the door. His blood pressure escalated with his anger. He knocked on the door repeatedly. How dare she not be here? That bitch. Where the hell is she? He mumbled through clenched teeth. He climbed back into his car, steaming mad, and pounded his fist on the steering wheel until it hurt. David waited in the driveway for more than an hour, hoping that she had just run to the store. As his anger subsided, he made his internal justifications. He would leave the tape with a nice note saying he was sorry he'd missed her and ask her to give him a call after she'd had a listen. He placed the tape and the note in the large mailbox at the curb. It was Sunday, so she wasn't likely to get it until she picked up the mail the next day. What was one more day in the grand scheme of things, he thought as he drove up the street. I've waited lifetimes. He turned the corner, glancing into his rearview mirror. He saw Andrea's car pull down the street from the opposite direction. David waited at the curb a few minutes and then parked two houses away behind a neighbor's van. He watched Andrea get out of the car and was surprised to see Eve with her. They walked into the house and closed the door. While they were together, David decided to take care of business. He started his car and drove to Eve's house. He slipped his key in the door, assured that he had at least a few minutes to get in and out before they could possibly arrive. He entered the living room, and a low growl came from Kaz. He hissed and spat at David. David shrieked when Cosmo leapt from the chair and landed on his shoulder. The crazed cat dug his front claws into David's brown leather jacket at the collar, while rear claws tore at the exposed skin of his neck. Get the fuck off me, cat! He flung the cat to the floor, but that was not enough to deter Kaz. The frenzied feline charged again and David thrust his foot down on top of the animal, grabbing it by the nape of its neck. He held Kaz at arm's length. David cursed under his breath and tossed the cat into the bathroom, then quickly slammed the door. There, grow some thumbs, you little prick, and maybe you can learn how to open doors. David clutched at the scratch on his neck. He was bleeding. He went through the living room and up the steps to Eve's bedroom. He walked straight to the clock radio and opened the tape deck. Empty. Damn.
Where did she put that tape? He looked around the room and searched quickly through her office. What the fuck did she do with that tape? The tape he'd placed in her bedroom was gone. He had to find that tape, but he wasn't sure how long Eve would be at Andrea's. He cursed under his breath. He went back to the bedroom clock, opened the tape deck, and stuck the replacement tape in the player. Back in the living room, he looked on all the tables. The cat banged itself against the bathroom door, yowling, which simply agitated David. He turned to the stereo cabinet, searched the stack of tapes and CDs that lay on top of the system. Nothing. Then he noticed one of his tapes inside the deck itself. He opened the door with a semi-satisfied grin and slipped the tape out. At least she didn't move this one. He replaced it with a new tape from his left jacket pocket and checked the timer, then stuffed it behind the equipment out of sight. I'll come back for the tape. It has to be here somewhere, he thought. Mission accomplished, he said, closing the cabinet. With only one old tape in his possession, David walked to the bathroom and turned the knob. He opened the door just enough so the cat could paw the door open. Don't tell her I was here, you furry fucker, he said. He quickly stepped out of the house, making sure that he locked the front door. With smug self-assurance, David Landrum drove away from Eve's house. He had her. It was getting close. He could almost taste sweet vengeance. She would pay. Oh, yes, she would pay. They would all pay. He would see to that. Thanks so much for joining me for this episode of The Mark of a Druid, and stop back again. Pick up the next episode at rhondacarpenter.com or themarkofadruid.com. So until next time, thanks, and take care.